Beyond is sponsored by the Malone Society, whose works help keep alive the plays we work on. The Malone Society regularly publishes volumes of early plays which otherwise might not be available. To join the Society or find out more about their publications, go to malonesociety.com for more information. Hello and welcome to this discussing episode with myself, Robert Crichton, and guests Annie Charlton and Elizabeth Ellsworth, as we talked last year about A Game at Chess by Thomas Middleton, a production which I was sadly not able to catch, in part because I just didn't know it was happening at the time. We do have an events page on our website for future events, not just by us, but by anyone doing a play from the early modern or the pre-modern period. And it's quite hard to know about those shows because it's such a wide and diverse area of interest. So if you have a production yourself of a play from before the closing of the theatres in 1642, or in fact a little later, I mean, I'm quite happy to promote anything, so long as it doesn't break our cardinal rule, let us know so that we can publicise and share it. So do get in touch, admin@beyondshakespeare.org, and let me know, and I'll put it on the mailing list, on the website, and generally shout about it, and say if, like this particular show, it's definitely within our wheelhouse, we might even ask you on and have a chat. So do not be a stranger. But till next time, over to past Robert and my chat with Annie Charlton and Elizabeth Ellsworth talking about A Game at Chess. Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today we are, it's be a terrible surprise to regular listeners, we're going to talk about Game at Chess. Don't worry. It's not going to be me talking about Game at Chess so much as other people, because like a terrier that's been given a new chew toy, we just won't put a play down once we picked it up. Game at Chess has so many episodes of the podcast available for you to go back and listen to, but we have managed to find somebody else who has actually worked on the play in an active on-stage version, and so I have two wonderful guests to talk about that performance now. So, my wonderful guests, who are you, and what is your purpose in life?
Hi, so my name is Anne. I work with York Shakespeare Project as a trustee for our local charity. Despite the name, so we were originally set up in York, in Yorkshire, to put on all of the plays of Shakespeare across a 20-year period. We achieved that, give or take a couple of years, which we're going to entirely blame on the pandemic, and then started in a new reincarnation to go back to the beginning, do all of the plays again, reimagine them. You can endlessly reinvent a play. But we didn't want to just replicate what we'd done before. So we're also including plays of Shakespeare's contemporaries and weaving those in, so kind of modern audiences get to see something that they might have been able to see in the same year or in the same few years at the same time. So that's how we came to A Game at Chess. We put on two big productions each year, fully staged productions, but we also put on a rehearsed reading each year, which is not a full stage production. It will have a kind of minimal budget, minimal costumes and set dressing, and it will be script in hand, so they only get one rehearsal. I'll leave Liz to tell you a little bit more about that as the director. But we chose to do A Game at Chess this year as part of our Spanish season, following up from a fully staged production of Thomas Kyd's The Spanish Tragedy. So I've always been obsessed with this play. I wrote my undergraduate dissertation on this play many, many years ago. I think one of the things that I love is how political it is, but also how it really, really draws together the idea of religion and politics as not two separate things in Renaissance England, but very much kind of one idea. I have been wanting for many, many years to see this on stage. I know quite a few years ago, the Globe in London were going to do a rehearsed reading themselves, and that got pulled at the last minute. So I feel like every chance to see this play has been sort of snatched away. So the only way to write that was to do it ourselves. And I was very, very lucky to have the support of my fellow trustees in our charity, but also to have a great director in Liz to kind of realise that vision. I had never been so happy in my life than seeing it. the other week. So I'll pass over to Liz, if that's okay, to tell you a little bit more about the production.
I'm Elizabeth Ellsworth. Everyone calls me Liz. And I've been attached to the York Shakespeare Project, both as an actor and now more recently as a director. I had taken part in the script in hand shows myself by other playwrights. And it's a really exciting way of bringing scripts or which probably wouldn't make it to a full length, full length play or to a main house production. And what's really interesting about A Game at Chess is that there really hasn't been, and I do not know why, a fully staged version by one of the big companies or, you know, to actually sort of bring this alive. So many people have told me that they know of it or have heard about it or have referenced it. So it does seem a shame. The way that the productions work is that you have one rehearsal only. So you have to have a brave set of actors who are quite prepared to turn up. We rehearse from about, 12:30 through to 6 on this case, a Sunday. And then we are on at 7:30 on a Monday and a Tuesday in a local space. In this case, it was one of our pubs, the Winning Post, at a lovely big room, which is usually a function room. So if you imagine it, it has a central dance floor, but we could put the chairs round it in a rectangular square shape, if that makes sense, which meant that we could have all the chess pieces, well, with the limitation of our cast of 12, but we could actually do the lineup, which is what is very much directed through the writing of the play. So that's where I came in.
Yeah, I just want to leave, there are a few points there just about the fact that people don't do this play. And I think there are two reasons for that. I think one is it's really hard to read.
Yes.
If you hand someone the script, because nobody has proper notes. This is why it's hard to discuss, even, for us to discuss now. I suspect in a few minutes' time, we're going to tie ourselves in knots trying to remember who is the Black Bishop's pawn and why and who and the thing, because they're really difficult names sometimes even to say and discuss, and they're really hard to read. It's almost impossible. When we did it, I don't know if you did this, I just gave everyone numbers in front of their names, because otherwise them finding where they were on the page was so hard. And I think the other reason, I'll see if you agree on this point later on, is that everyone talks about it in relation to the Spanish Match.
Yes.
And so it's like, oh, well, we need to do an essay first, so let's not do this. Of which I am convinced is a relatively large red herring. I don't think it's actually very important, because the plot is perfectly understandable, as long as you know that there are two countries and two confessions.
I would also say that having chatted to people who came along after the play, I think a lot of the feedback we got was along the lines of, I didn't have a clue what just happened there, but it was brilliant. Mm. I found it thoroughly entertaining. I laughed at everything. I don't know what the global picture of the play was, but it doesn't matter. And I think that really speaks to the direction and the kind of bringing out the incidents in the play, which in and of themselves are quite resonant whenever you're reading, listening, watching. But globally, it doesn't matter if you can't align it all with politics. I think you're right. People worry about that, but they shouldn't, because it's still funny, even if you don't understand everything.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about Gondomar's problems later, I'm sure. Elizabeth, so you had a cast of 12. So some decisions need to be made there, because obviously the cast there's presumably some eliding of parts or simplifications needed to occur there. What happened at the script stage, shall we say?
Yes, and I had one thing that I really enjoy doing when I adapt a script, and this is an adaptation because it has to be, we did not do the full length version. So hands up to that, because the remit is to do it in about an hour and 50 or now 2 hours with an interval in between. And it's also the pressure on the actors and the space, etc. So you look at the script and exactly what you've just said. It's not the greatest read. It is not the easiest read, because you have to keep going back and thinking, who these Black Queen's pawn, White Bishop, what's going on here? So, and actually what you're dealing with, I worked out, you've actually got two sets of characters in this play. You've got the characters in the world of the play, which, as Annie's just said, actually they do work. The stories work, whether you know anything about the Spanish Match or the political situation. And then the other set of characters who are equally intriguing, which are, in fact, the real people, the people that were being satirized mercilessly into a London in 1624, which is why it was so successful and why the King and the Privy Council shut it down after the 9 days. So you can start getting very obsessed with how do I make it obvious that the White King is in fact James I and James VI of Scotland? How do I make that obvious? So you can either sort of tie yourself up in knots with it, or you think, right, I think there are themes in the play, there are plot lines. My experience of working with Thomas Middleton before is he likes a good plot line. He loves lots of characters. My imagination is that he had a company with so many different talented actors and performers in that he was trying to interweave them and get them all in there, but also tell a story. And the fact that you have the characters in the life of the play. So you have the two sets of, you have the black chess pieces and the white chess pieces, and that they adopt their status roles. So you have a kings and queens, and you have the pawns. So the pawns obviously run around and do a lot of the doing in the play. Although you have the standoffs when the court actually come in and line up together and have the scenes, these big sort of court scenes in the play. So all of that very recognisable. And what you have to do with the script is say, well, right, what do we want from the story? And although you have great characters like the Black Knight, who has a phenomenal amount of time on stage, that's where some cutting had to come in because of length of time. But also a lot of what the Black Knight talks about is very, very relevant to political things that have been happening at the time.
He's doing the Ben Elton topical stand-up routine. Yes. That's the thing, isn't he? He keeps doing that. And that's sort of where that alienating factor comes in as well, that it's like nobody has a clue what he's talking about.
And a lot of it could still work. There was a bit which I did go, but there's a little bit where he talks about, I got the English to pay for our coastal defences, and we got that out of you. And with, you know, all the arguments between Britain and Europe, which go on for hundreds of years, that could still, you know, that would still get a laugh. But there's so much of it was so of the time that you'd have to, you could do a production where an actor made a rift on that, did a version of that now. But for the sake of doing this particular piece, we thought, right, there's enough in the play where he is fantastically Machiavellian. I love the scene with his pawn where they talk about, you could open my head and it'd be like a globe of the world with all these plots inside it, which I think is a wonderful scene, and the audience seem to appreciate as well. So you get enough of that and his plotting, and when it's actually up on its feet, the other thing that you see is the bluff and the double bluff and what people are doing even within the same side. So you can see when someone is actually saying, I am pretending to be this, but I'm in fact something else, which again, that never reads well on the page. But when you give actors the scripts, they love it because it's great.
Because it's a spy caper, basically. You know, there's undercover operatives. You've got you've got dead letterboxes. You've got all the tradecraft, which they actually go into quite a lot of detail. And there are moments where it feels like, you know, somewhere between James Bond and John le Carré, decide where you want to put your line there. Yeah. There's something weird about Middleton's plotting, because he doesn't always explicate very well or very clearly what's going on until after it's happened.
Yes.
Which is a problem when you've got someone, you need to get across that someone has been castrated and that someone has castrated them, which is not unimportant. It's a really surprisingly important subplot to understand.
Yes.
And it's sort of explained in the first scene, but in a way that is so opaque that it's incredibly difficult to get across, which is a shame because it's such a good payoff later on in the play.
I made it horribly obvious.
We had some wonderful testicles going on.
Yes, we had a jar with two walnuts in it at one point, being rattled in front of the White King's pawn. We had a little story where the white bishop's pawn that is done, and so he was chased round at the beginning and off with one of our actors with an ice cream scoop, and then coming back on with a jar with two walnuts in. It's very, very gross sort of panto, very in your face comedy, but people got it. And if you, I did do a little bit. Because I again, exactly your point, I tried to find the bit in the script where I could make it more obvious. And actually, people got it. People really did get that, maybe even without our sort of our play show of it. You could bring that in performance, I think, because otherwise those things are not always as obvious as you would like them to highlight to an audience. But it was interesting how an audience got that and did think that was funny. And the actors obviously reveled in being able to do something very naughty, which is quite fun.
Because, of course, it's, you get that closing scene where it's a matter of he's trying to figure out how to get redeemed for this act, which everybody finds appalling. And it's fascinating that that is the greatest crime you can commit, which is an offence to the big dick energy of the play. And so murder's fine. Murder's fine.
No, absolutely. And that scene, I think, got the greatest laughs of the... Mm. It's such a brilliant scene where you have the wonderful fat bishop who keeps changing sides all the time, and he's just one of the audience members said to me, "Oh my god, it was just so funny, but he's so sleazy." And you thought, "Oh yeah, absolutely, the character comes across." And the Black Bishop and the poor Black Knight's born who's done the deed, and he's worried actually all the way through the play. He's actually quite worried. Yes. He begins to get a conscience.
Yes.
And the Black Knight says to him, "Oh, you know, it's very rude to him. Say, oh, you know, you don't need one of those." But actually what's really interesting is that scene went down incredibly well, that you can get away with these atrocious crimes and killing, which is how Thomas describes it. But you can't, having done this terrible act on another human being. So, of course, the obvious thing is I'll go and kill him then. And the audience thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
So in terms of, again, the difficulty of reading the text, the advantage of putting on stage is you can put some visual signifiers in, and they're all chess pieces. How did you do that? He said, knowing the answer, tell our listeners at home.
Well, it's wonderful in York. You have so many talented people that contribute in any possible way. And a very wonderful friend of the York Shakespeare Project is a chap called Richard Hampton, who's a great crafter. And he made us chess piece hats out of cardboard. So basically we had the cast in black and white in their clothes as near as we could. And then I played the Black Queen. So I had a lovely chess piece hat, which was the queen figure. But that's so all the main character, the Black Knight, went around with a Black Knight chess piece on as a hat on his head. And so that certainly signified who everyone was from the status characters. So those of us that stood on the back row when you line up the chessboard, and the pawns wore black and white bobble hats with black and white costumes. And I think what really helped, and that helped with the structure of the play, is that there are three times that the two courts come and face each other. Mm. So with just as a chessboard would, the black on one side and the white on the other. And so that you saw, the audience sees everyone lining up at least once. There's some different configurations. One or two characters don't always be there, and that's in the script. But actually, that kept reinforcing, I think, who the characters were from the script.
And I would say, as an audience member, I couldn't imagine how we were going to do that, how you were going to pull that off at all, Liz, when I was thinking about going to see it, because obviously you've got this quite clear sort of split between black and white, but you've also got complexity within that, and it's not easy to remember who everyone is. We don't have any real budget to speak of to do these. So Richard was so, so creative. And the idea of doing that, it was just absolutely phenomenal. And it really did help to sell that kind of plot, the game aspect, and the understanding of how everything was moving around to the audience. It was really, really clever. It worked so well.
Mm. And it also denotes status really clearly, because the play is, you know, all of the people who do the action are the lower status characters on behalf of the higher status characters, pretty much until we get to the second half of the play when people go undercover. Those signifiers really help. How did you do the bag, by the way?
Oh, the bag. Yes. Hell's Mouth, the bag. We were able to set, the audience was sitting around the space in a rectangle. And then so the pieces could walk on, say, black versus the white. It actually belonged to my grandmother, but I have a chess table. So a lovely Edwardian chess table. So we put a chess set in the middle of that space. So that obviously denoted that we were already talking about a game. At the very beginning, we had the chess set up on a chess table right in the middle of the acting space. And we did have the black velvet bag, a black velvet in which we kept the pieces. So that was very much shown to the audience. We were doing it in the round, around this famous chess table. So that means it was very difficult to think about. I did think about, did we have an area off stage, which was with a black curtain or a black sheet? And that's where people were thrown in when they were taken. But what we did was that the characters kept bringing on a black velvet bag or a black bag. So when any, there was about into the bag and you're taken, which is a line that does come up quite a lot in the play. The character that was the main protagonist would be very much waving that bag, very much making it obvious and that you're taken and that you're off. So at the very end, the spoiler for those people for the play, when the characters that have been taken are now out of play do speak. And so for us, that was standing around the backs of the audience so you could hear their voices. But then the white characters who have the upper hand at the end of the play were actually holding the bag and the last chess pieces were being put in. So that's how we did that. We actually had a small bag on the stage.
And it's very much, it's structurally a play of two halves in the sense that the first half of the play is very much about this truth to power moment of, someone who attempted sexual assault and then the way institutions try and cover that up. And it's a very, very heavy plot line, actually. And then the second half goes somewhere else. And again, on paper, that looks unbelievably weird. When you look at the structure of it. Yeah. But how did that actually flow in terms of performing it? I know how it worked for us, but I'm just in that sense of something that on paper doesn't look like it should work. And how did it work?
Yes, no, it's fascinating. I am increasingly of the mind that Middleton writes incredibly strong roles for women. He certainly does in Roaring Girl, which we did a couple of years ago. But the two characters, the White Queen's Pawn and the Black Queen's Pawn, are fascinating because they do appear to have character changes all the way through this play. But what was lovely was to see the actors playing with that, because you have that, exactly as you say, in the first half, you have virtue assailed. You have, creepy, what turns out to be a very creepy scene in so many ways of a chap abusing power and her managing to get away. And then we later find out the Black Queen's Pawn's role in that. So that you might say, right, okay, we have the straight plot line and the story there. And I think the audience responded to that very much as an audience of 2025 would. They were very much sympathetic with the White Queen's Pawn. They were very empathic to that. And then, of course, in the next part of the play, the Black Queen's Pawn is clearly between the different camps, between the black and the white houses. You can see her moving between the two, but you don't actually know her motivation until much later in the play. And then they said, oh, we're now giddy girls. We're now sort of trying to get a date to go out with, where we're in a very different place. And they really embraced that. They decided to, they were now women together. They were now in a different place. It almost goes to like a suburban comedy. I adored the Egyptian mirror scene. It's a lot of fun. But you think, how could these characters be doing this after where they would come from?
It is a very strange direction shift. And it was like we had so many discussions, especially with the Black Queen's Pawn, of going, okay, what is your through line as a character? And go, I'm not sure you've got one. Hypothetically, there is one. And you explain at the very end of the play your through line. And it almost in passing to the point, again, where you don't quite grasp it. Why are you doing any of this? And it's sort of, you get the impression of sort of thinking this through as you're going along, Middleton, aren't you? Whereas I think
I think what
it works.
It works. And I think there's something around the December, the whole thing about people being what they are and not what they are, and the double bluff, and and obviously the Black Queen's Pawn knows that this is actually the bad character from the beginning, and it's all of that stuff. They ran with it. They said, let's go with being, we're now in a different space, we are now reacting to what's going on. There's a plot, there's a theme all the way through the play, that although the White Queen's Pawn is virtue and I'm going for the virtuous life, and but there is the double joke about the fact which everyone got, which is I've seen your husband and I will see and you'll have a man, a complete one. And that got a lot. So again, we get back to the castration theme and all that's happened before, and the implication that actually the White Queen's Pawn does want a fulfilled life in that sense. And they pick up on that. Again, it's not particularly moved forward in any way, but I think it sort of gave them a chance to show another another facet of women together and women together sort of trying to set up going out. And what do you think of this? And it's a lovely device. The Egyptian mirror scene is a great plot device. Again, very much like Misrule or English Panto. You know, it's a lovely, lovely game. And people enjoyed that. And then you go back to them being in a very different place. And he doesn't explain in the scene where eventually there is a, you know, the actual reasoning behind why the Black Queen's pawn is doing what she's doing doesn't become apparent right to virtually the very end. And then you, as you say, you could miss it, but it's such a beautiful three lines, and that she has exposed her, as we would feel now, abuser, and that now it's done. And that's actually prompted me to slightly tweak Thomas Middleton's ending, actually, because at the end of the original text, all the black pieces, including the Black Queen's pawn, end up in the bag, end up away. And when I got to that point and read and reread it and adapted it, I thought, no, we're not going to do that in 2025. So she didn't go in the black bag. But that was a director's choice to make.
I think what we did was actually she was just happy to go into it. It was like, I've done my job. This is the price I pay. And so I think she actually just goes, whee!
Yes.
Revs everybody else sort of went, into the bag. And I think that's what we did.
And I think you absolutely, I thought about that moment, and I thought a lot about to do that, not to do that, where we go with that. And I thought, no, and absolutely, if you did it, I've read commentaries which talk about if the White Queen's pawn is England and a morality play, you need all the white characters on one side and the black characters away. And that's how it would be seen, that actually she's achieved what she wanted. Great. You know, I don't care about anything anymore. But then that's bringing perhaps a modern sensibility into it. But then that's the director, you can do what you want.
Well, this is the thing. Ultimately, there are big questions about, you know, doing a full production where we've been sort of playing about the kind of framing devices we might throw in, the kind of adaptation we might do to sort of sidestep some of the you know, there are issues with performing a text like this today. There are a couple of interesting scenes. I also wanted to just question it. So did you do what we call the locomotion scene or the pawn scene?
The jesting pawns. No, they got cut.
Aww.
They got cut. And so that was, yes, I know. There are sometimes when you adapt to play, you lie awake thinking, oh no, did I do the right thing? It's a wonderful piece of total anarchic, probably quite rude theatre. and it comes in and goes out for no apparent reason, apart from it's just there. And it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. And in this version, it was partly time, partly number of actors. Interesting number of actors and who we'd got around.
Big scene with lots of people in it. And then, yeah, that makes sense.
Because I think what we'd like to do that properly, and fun, you need to do it, I think, from a personal point of view, you need to quite fast, make sure everyone knows what they're doing, choreograph it really well, do it, bang, out. And it would be absolutely fantastic and very, very funny. But I thought we just didn't have the time resources to get that to work as well as it really ought to do, particularly when you've got scripts in hand and all that sort of thing. So, and another show that would definitely be back in again. Yeah. Oh, yes.
It's a good opener for the second half.
No, absolutely. It's either a cracking ending for the first half where people go, what? Or just this incredibly crazy thing happens at the beginning. And I remember talking at work with someone about, oh, I've got this scene and I don't know. And it's a lot of very, modern comedy sometimes does completely anarchic things for absolutely no reason. There is reason. You can make a reason in there. There's also part of me that feels that there were actors who you had your clown troupe or the people that were very good at that physical comedy that probably didn't have a role in this show. I've got a feeling that they were sitting backstage and he wanted to bring them on.
I just wonder if it's a clearing the stage thing between, you know, that because the scene can either elide straight into the next, because of course there are different versions of the play that survived to us, quite a lot of different versions. So I'm just wondering if there was something about setting up the Egyptian glass that was just actually turned out to be a bit fiddly and annoying, so they thought, I'll throw this little scene in. Or we got some apprentices who we want to throw some dialogue at that they can rehearse separately. Is that sort of structural logic, not necessarily play logic? It's more outside the play.
Outside the play. And I thought there was also something about, because the play does have one or two quite erudite speeches. The White King particularly has these, you know, really quite sort of lofty speeches, making imagery, which are wonderful. And then you kind of think there are so many jibes between the two houses, quite rude humour. And then this is complete anarchy. So then you have the whole range between the two factions. So I quite like that.
Yeah, the White King's interesting because in the sense that he is utterly ineffectual as a character. So he makes these very long speeches. And it's sort of the question of, is there a satirical intent there, that this is the person who's talking about peace and talking about doing X, Y, and Z. But actually what it means is that he commits a massive injustice, because of course he doesn't want to hear the word rape. He doesn't want to hear about this, you know, because that's ruining the day. It's just, that's not very pleasant. So he just shuts down on it. And that's pretty much his first big scene as well.
Yeah. And I think the fact that they take such a superficial set of evidence to be, and and I think one of the worst things is that the White Queen then obviously turns her back on her pawn as well. So they leave and abandon her. And that, you know, with, you know, this ridiculous idea that the Black House has come up with to you know, the antedated letters, and that they didn't see through that. So you do sort of think, you wonder if that was showing that they weren't the most with it court. But again, there's always that issue that, you know, I am what I am, I say what I am, I'm not, as later on the White Knight talks about, he claims to be an arch dissembler when he's not, but we what we say is truth, so what we see is truth, so we expect other people to that standard, which is incredibly naive. So you do wonder if that depiction of the king, although he's noble and not saying anything wrong, does make him not the most intelligent king, really.
The play is more pro the next king than it is the current king. That you get that real impression of, you know, the figures of King James and King future King Charles. You know, there was a time when Charles was popular.
No, absolutely. And I think there's also I made the decision to reassign a few of, I sort of split some of the White King's line to the White Queen, because the White Queen doesn't have an awful lot to say, which gave her a little bit more agency, which I think was quite interesting, because towards the end there is the scene where she is assailed by the fat bishop is back, and then that is thwarted, and she does have a role in, I wouldn't say sorting out what happens at the end of the play, but she's quite important at the end of the play. So that felt okay.
The only other bit of business that's quite fiddly in the play is, of course, the undercover moment for the White Knight, etc., when they are invited into the Black House and they are presented with this wonderful ceremony that goes on for quite a long time. And, you know, how much Latin does an audience want?
How much Latin can we take, and why? And how much does the director decide we're going to cut through this a bit and get going? And I think that that's a bit where I thought, that was the scene where I thought, I would love to have the full-scale production. And I saw it in a very frugal hall, and they're having to listen to this for absolutely hours, and there's nothing to eat, and it's been terrible. You know, so you could sort of build on that if you wanted to. It's just a sort of an imagination. So we kept that fairly tight, because what I wanted, my impression of that scene was that, yes, it's about, they're undercover. They are being shown everything that's wonderful about the Black House, as far as the Black House know. Clearly, the Latin is the nod to the Latin Mass and to all of that, although it's a welcoming speech. So we had someone doing the reading the English at the same time so that people could vaguely understand that. And then actually the scene direction has that at some point a curtain, I think, is pulled back, and that there's an altar or religious statues, and there's some song and dance happens. So we did have musical license because we're in a pub, so some of the characters had come on in great big black cloaks with the candles, and at a cue point we suddenly blasted out Madonna's Like a Prayer, and we had a little bit of a boogie, at which the White Knight and the Duke were suitably shocked and horrified. So we slightly subverted that scene and made it a visual gag rather than maybe rely on the text, because we're just about to get an awful lot more text.
Well, there is song and dance, and I think that's a perfectly good analogue for that moment. I mean, we decided to actually make it add more music, so that we made the Latin oration into a mini opera that lasted literally 5 minutes, and everyone is every stanza they think it ends and then deflate when
it
keeps going.
Here it goes again. Yeah. My other thought was that we would do the whole thing, but people basically dying of boredom, falling down.
This is the thing. How do you make boredom entertaining?
Yes, making the gag. So we sort of slightly split through that, but I think, doesn't that show you that scene can be? I mean, that's just a couple of ways we've talked about. But actually, there is so much you could do with that. And I also wanted, a lovely, full-scale production, how you could do them going through the different, being introduced to the different things of the Spanish house, where you could stage it, where they could be, which rooms they'd be in, what you could bring in, what was going on with all the other characters. Could be great fun, actually.
Yeah, well, this is sort of my next sort of talking point, is just, talking about taking it further, because, doing the sort of iterations that we're doing and you've done there is, it's a stepping stone towards, and actually that imaginative leap to how do you do a fuller production is really important, that we shouldn't just stop here and say, well, that was it, well done, tick a box, move on, of actually saying, look, the first half of the play definitely speaks to today in a very direct way. There are so many parallels there that make it such an important play. There are other elements in the play that clearly need to go, and it's this question of baby and bathwater that I'm really interested in here, is that this play actually has massive potential. There are massive pitfalls on it as well. Just a thought to throw open there, going forward.
I think just to add to one of the things about going forward. So we are a charity. We don't we try and make enough money to survive off what we do, but we do also rely on the generosity of our very loyal audience and donations and membership. So we don't have a lot of money to throw at this. And when we were looking at putting it on, we wouldn't usually buy scripts, we'd use kind of open source scripts. For this, we couldn't find one, and I don't know whether you had any luck, so we ended up with generating a sort of open source text file into a script. And I would say, I think stuff like that, where you don't have the open source material to be able to put things on in the first place, can be limiting for people who don't have a budget to be able to do something. We do have that now, and we'd be more than happy to share it if you've got people out there listening who are thinking, my local area really needs a production of a game at chess. We have a script for that, and we'd be more than happy to share that around.
And actually, just speaking to our resources as well, we have done exactly the same thing. We have done it for the entire English Renaissance. So if anyone wants to play, we don't put them out on the website yet, the editorial standards on many of them are relatively low, but we do have effectively a resource there that we're looking for ways of putting out there. And there are many editions of A Game of Chess, but there aren't good acting editions. They're all on the academic side of things. Half the page is footnotes, and your hand snaps off at the wrist trying to hold it. So there is also a gap there that I'd really like to be looking at into filling.
What I loved about the show, these 12 fantastic people that agreed to do this and had really a lot of enthusiasm. One of the great things was doing something very new, that you people didn't really know this play. They really had to think about what was going on. Maybe if you are doing a production of a very well-known playwright of the time, and that you people are very familiar with the play. Sometimes people come with so many assumptions, but in this, it was great. Everyone was in the same place. Everyone was coming with a very new piece of work. And what was lovely, that even at the second performance, I had people talking about, well, do you know, if we did this, how would you do that in a big show? How would you? Mm. And there was a lot of discussion about, would you out the type of venue? Would you have people looking down on chess pieces? Would you have screens showing the chess moves? It's one thing that I didn't achieve in this show. Mm. I believe that if you are incredibly clever and look at, you can map, you know, map some of what happens in the play. I think it's
there are a couple of moves. I think it has been tried before and it falls apart after about 2 minutes.
Yeah, I've got to say the plot line is so complicated. I'm not sure. You can have a go with that if you wanted to make that a big thing. One thing that I did do in the show, coming back to a question earlier, is I wrote a short prologue. Mm. I didn't want to write an essay because I could be there for 10 hours, right? And even this person is this person. So in that, I decided to have the character I had. Thomas Middleton is called to the master of the revels, Sir Henry, and they have a discussion about the subject matter of the play. And in that, they inferred a little bit about the Spanish match and a bit about what was going on and a bit about the king. So that gave an introduction to that historical setting. I think there's something there that's useful, but it meant that we could actually identify the Black Knight as poor old Gondomar, who does have a very bad time in the show in some respects.
He has a very famous anal fistula. And we were reading a play from 1641. They're still going on about it 20
they
years
are still
later.
They are still going on about it. And there is actually the reference, isn't there, the famous footnotes in the book of, I think, three apprentices were whipped because of making comments or catcalling, Gondomar in London. So there's a little bit of that. So we did use the use of fart noises and other things when he came on, because we felt like that was we integrated that into the script. But we also put in little bits of the English history which people would know. So in the prologue, there is something where Henry Herbert talks about people being worried about papish plots, because the whole play is very much about you know, the Protestant Catholic thing. And at that point, we did the remember the 5th of November chanted at the back to underscore that dialogue. We did a little bit of the Spanish Armada at one point. Mm. There are two mentions of 1588. So we enacted that in a short way. So you can bring in the historical references in a way that may help or hinder. I don't know, but there is that. You might be able to make more of the king supposedly being James. And it depends on the costuming. I've seen one photograph of a production in the 1970s in an Oxbridge college where they were dressed in Jacobean costume. So they'd obviously gone the other way, not being chess pieces, but being the courtiers of the time. So that's another way of doing it, I suppose.
Well, to round off, because, of course, you were doing this in relative quick succession with Spanish Tragedy, another Spanish text. Yeah. So were audience members sort of coming to both and finding connections or getting a sense? Was that a useful synergy? Is that the right word to use? Probably not. But, you know, because that's one of the things we do is, you know, do seasonal works, putting lots of shows together and seeing what the weird parallels are. And this is perhaps a more, they're temporally quite far apart from each other. One is literally on the edge of the Spanish Armada itself, and one's the very other end of the relations with Spain before the Civil War. How was that parallel? Was it good, or did it sort of not necessarily connect?
I would say we have some quite loyal audience members who come to most things that we do, for which we are very grateful. So we definitely did have a bit of crossover there, because we had different directors and they were developed sort of quite separately in this case for various reasons. I don't think we had a huge amount of crossover in terms of drawing themes and things like that. I think what was more interesting was introducing two quite new plays to people. So doing the Spanish Tragedy, I would say, even amongst our regulars, Thomas Kidd is not a huge household name, everyone's discussing over dinner of an evening. So we're introducing sort of things that people don't know about. And I think being able to do two of those in quite quick succession it did stimulate people thinking. It was really interesting seeing the take-up from actors wanting to be part of things, and as Liz said, exploring those two plays from scratch. So we did have a little bit of crossover there, which was great to see as well. So I think it was probably more in the stimulating interest in sort of new things, things that people hadn't seen before, and slightly breaking down that fear barrier, I think, as well, of if I go and see something that's old that I don't know the story of, I won't be able to understand or enjoy it. And I think that's something that we always face as a bit of a challenge. And I hope we managed to overcome that a little bit.
Okay, so any final thoughts before we close? Any final plugs or things you want to throw in? The floor is yours.
Just to say, my thanks to York Shakespeare Project for giving me the opportunity, because it's a fantastic, I think it's such a fascinating play, and I really, really look to see that other production that I can go and see, and again have similar discussions, because it's fascinating. It's a fascinating show, and I think the way that you find out about how you get to the anatomy of a show, I think it's actually being able to do it, either direct, act. In my case, I was able to do both in this show, and I would commend that. And again, if anyone was interested in seeing the script that we put together from our show, I'm always happy to share that with anyone.
Yeah, and I think just a little bit of a plug, as I said before, we generally do three productions a year. So next year is a little bit Shakespeare heavy, but we do have a planned rehearsed reading of Beaumont and Fletcher's The Maid's Tragedy coming up, hopefully around February time. The following year, 2027, we've gone full on revenge tragedy for anyone who likes a bit of blood with their stage show, or a tiny bit of stage show with their blood, whichever way around you want to look at it. So we've got planned rehearsed reading of Antonio's Revenge by Marston coming up early 2027. And at the end of 2027, as a full stage production, we're looking to go back to a bit of Middleton with the Revenge's Tragedy. We're sandwiching Titus Andronicus somewhere in the middle there as well, if we're allowed to say that.
Act one's by George Peel, so it's fine. And
plenty more. You know, we're hoping to go through the full gamut of full stage productions of Marlowe, Johnson, Middleton, Webster coming up over the next sort of 10 years, with some weird and wonderful things coming up in the rehearsed reading spaces, including going abroad for a bit of Lope de Vega in 2028. So.
Well, all of that, well, there'll be links in the show description so that you can go out and find all of these things in the future. And hopefully we'll be able to have a chat with you again about some of those things. Some of those are my favourites. So that's all looking really rather good. Looking forward to a lot of that. And it'd be lovely, maybe even actually, to be able to come up and visit and see you in action would be lovely to try and to help in any way, if it's because we're here to promote as well as to produce stuff ourselves.
We'd love people to obviously come and see things that we do, because that's how things live in the world. But we have a rolling director basis, so anyone out there who fancies throwing their hat in the ring and becoming a director either of a rehearsed reading or of a full play, we always put call outs for directors, sign up to the mailing list, and you just put in a bid and we select a director. So there you go.
Well, that's it. We have run out of time. Alas, I could probably talk about Game of Chess all day, and frequently do. All that remains to thank my wonderful guests for being wonderful. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Thank you.
Thanks.